Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And this morning, Federal Reserve Chair Jerome Powell told the Senate Banking Committee in a virtual hearing that bold steps are needed to help the U.S. economy bounce back from the coronavirus.
The scope and speed of this downturn are without modern precedent, significantly worse than any recession since World War II. We're seeing a severe decline in economic activity and employment, and already the job gains from the last decade have been reversed. Well, more than 20 million people have lost their jobs, and recent Fed research shows that what others have also found, that people earning less are the ones being hardest hit.
Senators also had a lot of questions for Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin about that congressional oversight report released Monday that shows very little of the economic relief money meant for businesses and local governments has actually gone out. And joining us now is NPR congressional reporter Claudia Grisales. And Claudia, does Jerome Powell's message align with President Trump's message on the economy?
Not exactly. Trump is much more bullish on what we could see ahead for the economy. He's seeing a recovery. He's seeing it relatively sooner. Jerome Powell, on the other hand, is focusing on the time this will take. He says that it could be several months ahead of us, where we could see some difficult times ahead for the economy. He focused a lot on essential workers. So he deviates from the president's message, saying there could be a longer, more difficult road ahead for the economy.
I want to also ask you about something else. The newly created Congressional Oversight Commission report released on Monday found that very little of this $500 billion meant for a range of businesses and local governments has actually been released. Here's Secretary Mnuchin on what he said about that $500 billion.
I've allocated about half of that. And let me be clear, I am prepared to allocate the rest of that. The only reason I have not allocated it fully is we are just starting to get these facilities up and running. We want to have a better idea as to which one of the facilities needs more capital, as well as the potential for adding additional facilities.
I mean, Claudia, this money was allocated weeks ago. What else did Mnuchin and Powell say about the efforts to get this money out?
They are saying that same theme. They're reiterating that theme of they're trying to get up and running, getting that money out the door. This was, they do note, the most dramatic, quick kind of process for Congress in terms of approving all of this aid, about $3 trillion that we're at now, and in just a matter of weeks. So it has taken them some time to adjust, to get their programs up and running. But they say that is what they're in the midst of. They are working on that, and they're going to see a lot more progress in the weeks and months ahead for these lending programs.
There are also a lot of questions about some of the programs created to get this money out. So there's this Main Street Lending Program and the Municipal Liquidity Facility. Did senators express concern about the wrong businesses actually getting some of the money, or what entities that really need it won't get it?
Yes, there was a lot of concern on that end. On both sides of the aisle, Republicans and Democrats raising points about this. The Main Street Lending Program, that focuses on small and medium-sized businesses, the Municipal Liquidity Facility, that is for state and local governments. And there was concern that this is not happening quick enough. For example, we heard Senator John Kennedy of Louisiana. This is one area he really harps on when it comes to state and local governments. He wants to see more flexibility when it comes to loaning out money to these governments. Yeah. We're talking about frontline workers, and he wants to get it done quickly before this money goes away. It could go away by year's end, and that was his main concern. So that was a theme we heard harped on, both Republicans and Democrats raising that.
And Democrats were pretty aggressive in their questioning today. Ranking Member Sherrod Brown pressed Secretary Mnuchin for pandemic pay for low-wage essential workers. And Elizabeth Warren asked Mnuchin about businesses that were supposed to use the money to keep workers on payroll. Let's listen.
I take it your answer to my question that whether or not you're going to require, as part of the terms of the loan, that people be kept on payroll is no? Is that right, Secretary Mnuchin?
That was discussed with people on both sides of the aisle.
No.
And those rules for businesses have actually been relaxed, right?
So there is concern that there is not enough protections there, that businesses have been able to go ahead with their plans to cut workers and also seek help from these new programs created under these rescue bills. And so, yes, that's been a concern that has been raised again and again. Elizabeth Warren, a Democrat, she's been very keyed on that issue. And she was trying to get some sort of commitment out of Mnuchin today, but it didn't go that far to avoid these kind of job cuts.
That's Claudia Grisala. She's a congressional reporter for NPR. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's get an update now on Afghanistan, where the government is dealing with thousands of cases of COVID-19, as well as a recent spike in violence, including an attack on a maternity hospital in Kabul last week. 24 died, including mothers and newborns. There were hopes that the U.S.-backed deal with the Taliban in February would end the violence, but if anything, it's increased. This week, though, there are new efforts to start the next stage of the peace process to get the Afghan government and the Taliban together for talks. Sikandar Karmani is the BBC's Afghanistan and Pakistan correspondent. He's with us on Skype from the UK. And so, Sikandar, start with the attack on the hospital. No one's claimed responsibility, but who would do that? You know, the Taliban, ISIS? Why would they? Because, you know, these images were horrific.
Well, you're right. That was one of the most shocking attacks that there's been in Afghanistan, since this conflict began, or certainly one of them. The U.S. government has said that they believe that the Afghan branch of the Islamic State group were responsible. And now, you know, that's quite feasible because this took place in a Shia neighborhood of Kabul, and ISIS in Afghanistan have repeatedly targeted this neighborhood. They've also repeatedly targeted, you know, soft targets in this way, killing large numbers of civilians. I reported on the aftermath of an attack on a tuition center that killed, I think, you know, over 50 teenage students in that same neighborhood.
But Sikandar, catch us up. I mean, what's the relationship between ISIS and the Taliban? Are they, allies, or would ISIS do this to make people think it was the Taliban and make the Taliban look bad? What's the role of ISIS here?
There's a couple of possibilities here that people are speculating about. One is that ISIS was responsible, but deliberately didn't claim responsibility, either because they thought that they'd gone too far, probably unlikely given their kind of brutal behavior in the past, or because they deliberately wanted to create more chaos and create more suspicion. And the reaction of the Afghan government to this attack has been to say that we're going to go on the offensive for the first time against the Taliban because of increasing levels of violence in the country. So potentially ISIS got what they wanted, which is a greater level of friction between the Afghan government and the Taliban. ISIS and the Taliban are enemies. ISIS and the Taliban have been fighting against each other. The Taliban see ISIS as a threat to them. They don't want their hardline members to defect to ISIS as the peace process goes on. They've been quite effective at times in really squeezing ISIS out of the parts of the country in the east of Afghanistan where ISIS had managed to set up camps. This attack is puzzling, and the lack of a claim of responsibility is puzzling, but certainly the U.S. government seems to believe on this occasion it was done by ISIS.
So, Sikandar, just briefly, with the U.S. and NATO troops pulling out after this, and I'm doing air quotes, negotiated peace deal with the Taliban, you know, the Afghan government wasn't a part of that. Is there a sense that the Afghan government is up to dealing with not just the Taliban, but ISIS?
So in terms of the withdrawal of American forces, 4,500 troops would be withdrawn from Afghanistan by this summer. Then if talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban begin by next year, we could see the remaining 8,600 U.S. troops withdrawn. So far, these intra-Afghan negotiations are yet to begin. But, you know, a crucial point about all of this is that even if we get to a point where those intra-Afghan negotiations begin, we could see potentially the U.S. withdrawing before they reach a conclusion. And those talks are going to be really, really difficult because somehow we've got to reconcile the modern, contemporary Afghanistan, which at least in some parts has seen a significant progress on human rights, on women's rights, on free media, for example, with the vision of the Taliban, which still largely consists of the Islamic Emirate that they had when they were in control of parts of the country in the 1990s. So those are going to be long, difficult discussions. And if the Americans decide to withdraw all their troops before those talks have concluded, I think a lot of people are worried about the risk of the violence escalating and worry how the Afghan government would be able to confront the Taliban by themselves.
And also maybe confront the coronavirus at that point. The BBC's Pakistan and Afghanistan correspondent Sikandar Karmani speaking to us from the UK about the situation in Afghanistan. Sikandar, thank you.
Thank you.
And now, a Here and Now exclusive about air travel. While most airlines are still flying a tiny percentage of what they did a year ago, in the single digits, like 7%, one airline is much, much busier, doing about half the business they did last year. And Allegiant Air, a budget airline that's big in the heartland, seems undeterred by the pandemic to the point of not requiring face masks. Seth Kaplan, Here and Now's transportation analyst, is reporting on this exclusively. Seth, thank you for being here. And no masks. Look, some people might not have even heard of Allegiant Air. It doesn't have a big presence in coastal cities, but it is one of the top 11 airlines in the U.S. So tell us more about it first.
Yeah, and it serves places like New York and Boston, but just a tiny player there. It's in the heartland where if you live in a place like Wichita or Fargo and you want a nonstop flight to Orlando, Allegiant, which is an ultra-low-cost, no-frills budget airline, is often the only option, and the flights can be pretty cheap. There are airports in this country where it's the only airline, period, and a lot of them where it's the biggest.
Yeah, and you find it's actually flying a lot relative to other airlines. You know, why and how much more?
Yeah, I wanted to really compare apples to apples because this is such a moving target that I've seen reports of what airlines are scheduling compared to what they used to schedule, but then some of them cancel a lot more flights at the last minute than others. So I asked the data analytics company Cirium to help me overlay that schedule data with the operational data, and I found that Allegiant is now back up to 53% of what it was flying a year earlier. That's for the 7 days to last Friday. And that's actually a big surge from even a week earlier. Now, Robin, 53%, if I would have told you months ago that an airline had cut nearly half its flights, you would think that airline's in trouble. But that 53% compares to an average in the U.S. of 24%, an average globally of 20%, and airlines like JetBlue, just 8%. Spirit, just 7%.
Well, you know, why is that? Because Allegiant Air, you could say, is comparable to Spirit. So why?
Indeed comparable. You know, Spirit and Allegiant, both those are the first two airlines, for example, to charge not only for checked bags, but also for carry-on bags. So, the product is very much alike, but the networks are nothing alike. Spirit... Well, let's see. Its biggest route last year in terms of how busy it was from New York LaGuardia to Fort Lauderdale. Allegiant's busiest market was Asheville, North Carolina to Fort Lauderdale. And so JetBlue, which, yeah, the product looks nothing like Spirit, but the network looks a lot more like it. It, too, New York to Florida, Boston to Florida, transcontinental markets that fly over the heartland. Those are JetBlue's busiest markets.
Yeah, well, and by the way, we're going to post the full ranking from Allegiant to Spirit, everyone in between, at herenow.org. But Seth, just quickly on the other big difference, all other major airlines are requiring masks. You can't get on without one. Allegiant merely encouraging them, and that doesn't seem to be hurting them. People are getting on board. What's going on there?
And to be clear, they very much encourage them, and they've gone beyond other airlines in one regard. They're handing out what they call health and safety kits that include a free mask and wipes and gloves. So they want people to wear them, but they just think that requiring it causes all kinds of problems. And they pointed to reports that not everybody's wearing masks on other airlines, and in the report by Reuters that United, American, and Delta have even told their flight attendants not to get in fights over this. So Allegiant using the carrot— rather than the stick, kind of like a lot else with the pandemic in the heartland, encouraging but not mandating use of the mask.
Seems to be working for them. Seth Kaplan here now, transportation analyst. Well, I can't even imagine getting on an airplane without a mask and maybe a hockey helmet. Seth, thanks as always.
Likewise, Robin. Thank you.
Well, we've been talking today about people who are very vulnerable, people with autoimmune diseases like lupus, being especially vulnerable to COVID-19, and now perhaps even more so, because there's a shortage of hydroxychloroquine. That's the anti-malarial drug 1.5 million lupus sufferers rely on to control the dangerous inflammation, organ damage, and fatigue that lupus causes. Shortages that started after President Trump and others hailed it as a treatment for COVID-19. Then yesterday, the president went further and told stunned reporters he's been taking hydroxychloroquine to prevent COVID-19, something there is no evidence will happen.
So I take medicine? I have been taking it for about a week and a half.
Every day?
At some point, every day. I take a pill every day. At some point, I'll stop. What I'd like to do is I'd like to have the cure and or the vaccine, and that'll happen, I think, very soon.
Well, put aside the dangers of taking it without scientific evidence. Stacey Beelan from Spencer, Massachusetts, was watching. She has lupus. Stacey, hydroxychloroquine, the brand name is Plaquenil. How is the president's messaging about this playing out for you?
So this actually goes back to April, and my brother Justin sent me a text asking if I take Plaquenil, and I didn't know about the shortage, but very soon after that, felt it. So I take it intermittently for lupus, and lupus is a disease where increased stress aggravates your symptoms, and simply the stress of not having access to this medication increases stress.
Well, back us up. When you say you felt it, do you mean that, like others, we're hearing going to get their refills, and they either couldn't get them at all, or they got a smaller amount than they normally get? How were you feeling it?
Right. So I became symptomatic, and I spoke with my doctor, and she said that there was a blanket letter that said it was now being redirected to patients with COVID instead of patients with lupus, and that I would not be able to access it. I actually resorted to a friend that had a leftover supply, but certainly that's not the way healthcare should work.
Orders for the drug spiked by 3,000% during the first 2 weeks of March compared to typical demand. And this is according to Premier Inc., that's the medical consulting and data collection company. And people are drawing a direct line to the president starting to tout it. And I just want to also flesh out this picture of lupus. It's chronic, but it's not something that's every day. You can go a while without feeling what, and then you have a flare-up of what?
I experienced sort of multi-system organ issues. My last hospitalization was in January, and they were able to stabilize me. I was in the hospital for about a week and a half. The problem really is that I'm experiencing a flare right now, and the medication that I take to treat that flare that keeps me out of the hospital for a week and a half is Plaquenil.
Or hydroxychloroquine. So again, lupus sufferers, you know, they have this, like the body's attacking itself. Heart tissue can swell,
right.
Lungs inflamed, filled with fluid. It's painful, but yes. Hydroxychloroquine decreases some of this cumulative damage. Given how important it is to you and that it is proven that it works for lupus patients, and there is absolutely no evidence that it either treats COVID-19 and certainly none that it prevents it. Your thoughts when the president said he was taking it?
I think that's a very dangerous game to be playing. The initial studies showed that it actually didn't help. And playing a game with people who regularly take this medication so that they don't end up in the hospital is extraordinarily hard to believe.
You tweeted out, I need this. If everybody's getting it, there's not enough or none for people like you.
Right. And there have been many stories where people with severe to mild cases of lupus have not been able to access this medication and have ended up in ICUs taking up beds. It's very, very dangerous for the president to say these things and for people to take the medication who don't need it and take that away from people who do.
Not only are you somebody with lupus, but you're also, interestingly, a frontline worker in a home for mentally disabled young women.
That's right. I'm a program coordinator for what we call a group home. I'm working overnights because many of our frontline workers don't want to come in because they're worried about the increased exposure. My overnight simply couldn't do it. She has a person in her life that has autoimmune issues. And I was supposed to be working from home, but I was redeployed to working the overnights.
So let's just make sure we underscore this. So you are a frontline worker, an essential personnel working in healthcare with mm-hmm. an autoimmune issue yourself, mm-hmm. concerned that you're not going to be able to get the medication that you need for your lupus because the president mm-hmm. and others are touting it as a prevention or cure for COVID-19, which is the thing that mm-hmm. you with an autoimmune disease are hoping you don't get. How are you feeling right now?
I think on a day-to-day basis, I just carry a great deal of worry as I become more symptomatic. I worry about the ladies that I care for. I worry about my stepdaughters, and I worry about going to the hospital, not only because it would be a pretty serious issue if I was admitted, but it also takes beds away, and it's preventable. Yeah. If I had my medication, I would feel much better. I would be more healthy, and there wouldn't be that much of an exposure risk.
And to be clear, do you have no medication right now because there's a shortfall?
Yes, that's correct.
Well, we hope that changes soon. That's Stacey Beeland, a mom working in group homes, but also somebody with lupus who can't get a hold of her hydroxychloroquine because it is being stockpiled by people who think that it either prevents or treats COVID-19. There is no proof of that. Stacey, we wish you well, and we hope you get a hold of some soon.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that.
Your thoughts welcome. HereAndNow.org.
President Donald Trump has escalated his threats to permanently freeze funding to the World Health Organization. In a letter posted on Twitter, the president said he would cut funding if the organization does not commit to improvements in the next 30 days. And for more, let's bring in NPR's global health and development correspondent, Jason Beaubien. And Jason, this comes, people might remember, after Trump temporarily halted funding to the organization last month. Can you remind us of what Donald Trump is contending?
Yeah, you know, the president has been saying for weeks now that the WHO and China downplayed the severity of this outbreak, especially in the early days. And he's basically saying that the WHO, if it had done its job, the virus could have been contained in China. And it's not entirely clear that that was ever going to be possible. But he's gone as far as to accuse the WHO of engaging in a cover-up with China. And this latest letter, in which he tweeted out overnight, he makes this same complaint, but he lists what he views as the evidence. And one thing that's interesting is the very first thing he asserts is that the WHO, in his words, consistently ignored credible reports that the virus was circulating in Wuhan in early December of last year. And he also said that some of those reports were in the prestigious medical journal, The Lancet. However, This is not true, and The Lancet issued a statement this morning saying that the first report they published on the novel coronavirus was on January 24th.
Yeah, yeah. Let's talk about the contributions to the WHO. So the United States is the largest contributor to the WHO, which is seen really as the preeminent global health organization. What would it mean for the U.S. government to stop funding?
Yeah, I mean, this would be a huge blow to the WHO. The U.S. is the largest donor. It gives roughly $450 million a year. It's sort of a complicated formula with the richer nations giving more. The U.S. is the largest economy in the world. China gives far less. But at this annual gathering, they pledged another $2 billion. They had the annual gathering of the WHO's member states this week. It just wrapped up this morning. The U.S. contributions are about 20% of the WHO's annual budget. This wouldn't just be a blow to the WHO. In a way, it really would be a blow to sort of the idea of post-World War II multilateral international cooperation if you have the U.S. pulling out of such an important institution.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit, though, about Trump's criticism. So he basically calls the WHO very China-centric. A lot of critics around the world have also said that the World Health Organization is too swayed by China. As you mentioned, China just pledged this huge amount of money to the organization. Yeah. What are you hearing?
Yeah, it is interesting, right? It also, at this World Health Assembly, which just wrapped up, the WHO puts that on and brings together all of these member states. And one of the leading speakers was China President Xi Jinping. He's one of the first heads of state scheduled to address the gathering. There is a lot of, it looks like, deference to China. However, the UN does this with most of its member states. They're very hesitant to criticize their member states because their member states basically control the WHO. They're part of the UN agency. This is the way that they do business. And so sometimes it looks like they're being overly China-centric. They actually, it's the way they operate.
That's NPR's Global Health and Development Correspondent, Jason Beaubien. Thank you.
You're welcome, Tanya.
If you normally work in an office, I'm sure you've been thinking a lot about what the future of your work will look like. Well, we're hearing how companies like Twitter and Square are allowing employees to work from home forever. We're thinking, will other companies join them? Will we ever get back to the office? Let's get a view from another big company. Salesforce is a software and cloud computing company based in San Francisco. And full disclosure, they are NPR underwriters. The company has over 50,000 employees with offices in more than 160 locations around the world. That's a lot of offices to reopen. Elizabeth Pinkham is Executive Vice President for Global Real Estate at Salesforce. And Elizabeth, welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, Tanya. Thank you for having me.
Well, first of all, is there a discussion at Salesforce about what Twitter is doing, letting workers do their jobs from home forever, even after this coronavirus crisis is over? You have this big, beautiful building. It's new in San Francisco. This idea of having employees work from home could save Salesforce a lot of money, right?
You know, it's funny, right, how quickly this all happened. And we have a lot of beautiful buildings and towers all around the world. And as you mentioned, over 50,000 employees. And when all of this happened, it really went down so quickly. I know it's like that for everybody as we think back. And it was almost like a light switch got flipped, right? We all went to working from home very rapidly. But when we're thinking about coming back into the offices, which we are, by the way, we're thinking of it more as like a light dimmer, like starting to kind of slowly come on, because we're building a really careful and thoughtful plan for everyone's health and wellness in mind, of course, to be able to come back into these offices and to get back to work in the office. But I think the other thing, and you sort of alluded to it, it's kind of incredible with everyone working from home, how successful that's been. And that's been a big awakening for us, something that I don't think anybody really expected.
Yeah. So I'm imagining you all are having discussions about this. You're preparing plans for a phased reopening of Salesforce offices. Will each of your locations come up with different reopen dates and plans? I mean, we're thinking about how the coronavirus is affecting even counties by counties, let alone states and continents.
It really is. And what we decided early on is we needed to have a set of guiding principles. We needed to have a vision and then a guidance decision matrix that could be applied really location by location. And that includes looking at local government guidance, looking at what our own local executives management are telling us is happening on the ground there in that city or country, and all the way through to what the health system capacity is in that particular city and region. So we have an incredible set of guiding principles. And then off of that too, now we are basically doing what you mentioned, which is having a plan location by location, but it's really all guided with the same set of values.
How is your work day, your own workspace, changed, and how is it going to change once you all kind of solidify these plans? Because so much has to change.
Well, we've really been knee deep in kind of this new world of reimagining and redesigning what the workplace is going to be like. Because when we do come back, it's going to feel and it's going to look pretty different. You know, everybody's been talking about social distancing, physical distancing, and that has been something that we have really had to embrace and think through. So we've been working with our architects, our interior designers, and everybody to look at each and every floor plan. So for example, a floor that used to have, say, 100 seats is now only going to have 40 to 50 seats because of the physical distancing. A meeting room that used to be able to have 14 people might only hold 5 people. So this is really a new world. And how do you put the designs out there and visual cues and everything else, right? Not to mention all the new health protocols.
There are also just some of the really small things that we take for granted that can turn into big things. I'm thinking about elevators, and I actually have been to your Salesforce building in downtown San Francisco. There's a huge, wonderful rooftop garden, but you have to take an elevator to get there.
You do.
And so what about even the practical things like elevators?
Well, you know, it's funny you bring that up. A couple of days into this new world of working from home, when we had already started thinking through the plan to come back, and we all sort of had this collective gasp as somebody brought up elevators. Right away, we realized that that is a choke point. I mean, that could really bring the whole thing down. So it kind of opened a door for us, quite honestly. This thing, which at first appeared to be, you know, a showstopper, it kind of opened a door, and it helped and forced us to think about all of this in a brand new way. So the way that we're really thinking about it is more about, again, phasing to come back, but maybe more about team shifts and managing groups to come in at particular times and giving them staggered arrival times. And this is all of a sudden this huge challenge to manage. And so what we saw is essentially these big piles of data management problems. And how do you solve for that?
I'm also thinking about ventilation systems and windows that don't open in buildings, those types of things as well.
It's absolutely part of it. And so we are envisioning this kind of new daily habit, if you will, right? We'll have face coverings for everybody. So we'll be providing those to people as they come back into the office. We'll be helping them remind about frequent hand washing. We'll have hand sanitizer stations everywhere. We'll do the thermo-infrared imaging for the temperature reading in our larger lobbies as you walk in. And then on every floor, we'll have a touchless temperature reading kiosk station. Right. And of course, social distancing, physical distancing reminded everywhere. And then what you brought up is so true. How can you bring in as much fresh air as possible? Can you open up windows where you can? Can you turn off some of these more in-depth air recirculating systems? Right. Can you run exhaust systems longer? So we kind of have a long checklist of this stuff that we are going to all of our different building owners and landlords and asking, how are you approaching this? This is what we're being told by our medical advisors is the right thing to do. And we're having to kind of do this assessment and readiness plan for each and every location.
Yeah. Health and safety is the number one priority, of course. But have you been thinking about, you know, the other side of work, not only the productivity of the work that you do, but the social aspect of it? Groups not being able to perhaps talk face-to-face anymore or have that social aspect. This building that you built in San Francisco was built with the idea in mind that employees would be able to interact with each other and the general public would be able to use this building in this way. Have you all had those discussions?
We have been having those discussions almost since day one, really, because what you bring up is so important to us, which is really about the culture, right? And about the collaboration and the innovation and making sure that we can bring that back and give people those opportunities as quickly as we can with health and safety and wellness, of course, being your top priority. We just looked at some data that came back from some employee surveys. And what we're finding is that the majority of our employees surveyed, they came back and said, we do want to come back, but we may not want to come back 5 days a week in the building. We may want to work from home a few days and come in a few days. And that has really even opened up another whole world for us, which is where I'm starting to think of this as maybe this is an opportunity to be a bit more thoughtful, maybe a bit more intentional about how you do bring people back. So you could create these teams that really benefit from seeing each other, and you could create the space for them and the capacity for them to come in a few days a week And then they can still be productive when they go home to continue working from home. And that way you can really make your space go even further while you're keeping that culture alive, right? Because I think all of us at this point in time are really ready to see people face to face again. And we're looking forward to that happening.
Are you worried at all about liability? You know, workers being together in a space where the chance is greater that infections will occur.
Well, the way we're looking at this is at the end of the day, there are a lot of things you cannot control, right? Like public transportation. But in the buildings, we can control quite a bit. And so I'll just give you one example, cleaning. We're probably going to double, maybe triple what we invest in cleaning. You're going to see people in our offices cleaning all day long. Before, you never used to see that, right? Anywhere. Mm-hmm. And then we'll be doing deep cleanings several times a week. And then also, if someone does test positive, right, which we have a whole plan for that as well, if that happens, we're ready. That means that we then come in with an even higher level of cleaning. That's the decontamination level. That's the, you know, the big level that you immediately go to, and you clean that whole floor, and then you start doing the manual contact tracing. But again, if you're able to kind of think about it like how you're managing these team shifts, then you're able to also shut that floor down, bring another team to other floors, and keep going.
Elizabeth Pinkham is Executive Vice President for Global Real Estate for Salesforce. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And we're constantly hearing references to the Great Depression now, as in, we now have the highest unemployment since. At that time, President Hoover thought the marketplace could take care of things, but then came FDR and his New Deal. And it's worth remembering the roll-up-your-sleeves initiatives that came out of that time in history, including the Civilian Conservation Corps. In this clip, we hear about some of the jobs created by the CCC in Birmingham, Alabama, in 1937.
The city has enrolled hundreds of Civilian Conservation Corps workers in the task of developing the Alabama State Park system.
Well, now there's a call to do something like that again, to create jobs for young men and women to help in the pandemic. Meg Jacobs is a professor and historian. It runs in the family. She's the wife of Julian Zelizer, longtime friend of this show. They both teach history at Princeton. She's writing a book about the New Deal. Professor Meg, welcome.
Thank you.
And so CCC, what was it? How did it come together back in the 30s?
The Civilian Conservation Corps was one of the flagship New Deal programs that Franklin Roosevelt got behind as a cure to the Great Depression of the 1930s. It was one of the first measures that he put before Congress and that Congress rapidly passed within weeks of his inauguration in 1933. And the idea was to create a tree army of unemployed men to do two things, really: provide jobs for the youthful unemployed. And the program was aimed initially at men 18 to 25 years old. And the other idea, as its title suggests, was to embark on a nationwide program of conservation to harness the country's resources.
They built the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, built bridges, roads, irrigation canals. A lot came out of the New Deal and in the decades later. But before that, there were no food stamps. There were no checks coming to people. I mean, these young people, many of them were hungry.
For sure. And by the time Franklin Roosevelt comes into office in 1933, the country had been through several really harsh winters of the Depression, which saw bread lines, people being so hungry that there were reported stories of children chewing on their own fingers until they bled. This was a nationwide phenomenon, both in the cities and in rural areas, of true desperation. This was a desperate society without any kind of social safety net to rely on.
Right. Well, and by the way, how did it work? I've always wondered about this. Did somebody just go sign up and then they got like a jacket or something and they got an assignment?
That's a great question. You would sign up in your local community. At the country's peak, the CCC put 3.5 million men to work in more than 4,000 camps spread throughout the country in every state. And it was a massive effort coordinated by the federal government with local involvement.
Okay. And a tremendous success. 3 million people probably lifted not just out of poverty, but set on a track for the rest of their lives. And now Congressman Josh Harder, who's a 33-year-old Democrat from California, wants to do the same thing today for younger people he says have been harder hit now than maybe other generations because they were also hit by the 2008 recession. He says, now let's create a coronavirus service corps to create all sorts of different kinds of jobs that would help in this pandemic. For instance, maybe they would be contact tracers or help in sort of low-level, non-medical jobs in the healthcare industry, or maybe social service jobs like helping with the elderly, you know, bringing food, doing some of that shopping that we're seeing people do, maybe deliver things, help with the homeless. They could even be temperature screeners because every company is saying they're going to take temperatures at the opening of their companies. Your thoughts about how this might translate decades later?
Do it. It sounds like a great idea. And this might indeed be a case where history helps to provide somewhat of a roadmap. One thing that I think we learn from history, and we often forget it, is how radically new the idea that you could sort of look to and rely on the federal government to quickly mobilize the population. And so while it seems like what we're talking about with the CCC is, you know, a tree army out in nature, no technical skills, just the vast effort required to sort of organize these thousands of camps providing millions of jobs in an era where the federal government did not do anything on that kind of scale is quite remarkable. I mean, we're talking about a moment in time in when we call it a tree army. The real army was not even that large. So we shouldn't underestimate the ability to rapidly mobilize in a moment of crisis and help people to, in turn, help their country.
We did it. We did it before, is what you're saying. Meg Jacobs teaches history at Princeton. Professor Meg, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.